Welcome to a special bonus edition of The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. There is a plausible parallel universe in which our guest for this interview is about halfway through his first term as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. In 2010, David Miliband, having served as Foreign Secretary for 3 years, stood for the leadership of the Labour Party, who had recently been consigned to opposition. He lost, narrowly and excruciatingly, to his younger brother Ed Miliband, who then lost the 2015 general election. David Miliband left British politics and moved to New York to become, in 2013, president of the humanitarian organisation the International Rescue Committee. Reflections on his work there so far inform his new book, Rescue: Refugees and the Political Crisis of Our Time. David, welcome to Monocle 24.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Rescue, it's a political document, obviously, but it's also clearly personal for you. There's that very arresting opening line that the first refugees you met were your parents. Do you think, one of the problems in communicating about refugees, forming policy about refugees, is that it needs to be made personal for everybody? Refugees tend to be seen as this monolithic, amorphous mass.
Yes, I think that's a really good point, that the biggest challenge we face today in explaining that there are 25 million refugees in the world, 40 million people internally displaced, the biggest challenge is not actually distinguishing them from 250 million economic migrants around the world. People understand the baker whose bakery in Damascus is bombed, the girl who's driven out of her school in northeast Nigeria by Boko Haram. They understand that they're a particular category. The biggest problem we face is that it becomes a dehumanized mass. And in part, that's because these are people far away. But it's also because of demonizing and dehumanizing rhetoric that is used about them. And so when I was thinking about my book and trying to do more than simply provide a policy guide to the refugee crisis, I wanted to write something that was readable rather than just a policy paper. I thought it was right to say, look, I'm British, I'm working in America, but I'm the son of refugees. My dad was a refugee from Belgium, my mum a refugee from Poland in 1946. And so there's a personal element to it. And I think we in the NGO movement, to speak that rather more broadly, have not done a good enough job of giving voice to the refugees themselves. Because that's actually the best way to break down the dehumanization is not for me to speak for them, but for refugees to speak for themselves.
Another line that did leap out at me from the book, and you mentioned there the distinction between refugees and economic migrants, but you talk of being both hard-headed and big-hearted, I think is your phrase. Is a measure of the hard-headed aspect necessary in differentiating between economic migrants and refugees, which is to say, if a tougher line was taken on purely economic migrants, might it make people more sympathetic to refugees?
Well, I think that is a good example. I don't think it's about being tough or soft, but I do think you've got to be able to say, if you're arguing that refugees have special rights in international law, that given that they're fleeing persecution, they have a right not to be sent home, and that therefore states have an obligation to take them, you've then got to be able to bite the bullet and say, look, if someone claims to be a refugee but isn't, doesn't pass the test of whether or not it's safe to be sent home, you've got to then say it's right that they are returned to the country that they came from. And that is tricky and difficult, but not just me. I mean, the Pope, who has been the most extraordinary advocate for the world's refugees, I quote him in the book, he says, look, you've got to maintain the integrity of the system. And that means that if people don't qualify for refugee status, then they can't stay as refugees. I think that the other point a bit, slightly more subtle point, is that immigration policy is a matter for national choice. Different nations can decide they want more or fewer immigrants. But those who have signed the Refugee Convention, providing haven to refugees is no longer a choice. They've made their choice by signing the Refugee Convention. They've said they won't return people to places where they're not safe. And that's why there are responsibilities on states that have signed the Refugee Convention, 160 countries have done so, that are different from the responsibilities in respect of immigration.
But do you think countries do need to take a harder line against the purely economic migrant? And this is obviously the economic migrant operating outside official systems and processes. I make the distinction there because I am myself an economic migrant, basically, in this country. But at what point is a wealthy, secure country entitled to say to people from a poorer, less secure country that, you know, it's not really our problem?
Well, I don't think it's a question of whether or not it's our problem. I think it's a question of a national choice. And I think it's right that different countries can make different choices according to their demographics, according to the number of immigrants that they've got, according to social or political preference. Japan is the prototypical example of a country that has insulated itself from global migration. It's decided not to broaden its base. It's run into all kinds of economic and demographic challenges as a result, but that's its choice. And I think you've got to respect those national choices. There are countries across Europe who have got bigger demographic problems than others, bigger demographic challenges than others. Germany is a prime example of a country that does need to take more immigrants. So I think one's got to have a case-by-case approach to this. And obviously you see that in the US, which has not been able to pass any immigration reform for 30 years. That leaves it in a very vulnerable position. But unfortunately, the vulnerability is transferred to the refugees. One of the points I make about the US politics is that, in a way, refugees paid the price of the confusion and dissatisfaction that exists with the stasis on immigration policy, the 11 million undocumented immigrants in the US. And when immigration policy and refugee policy become confused, I don't think it's good for either immigrants or for refugees.
Do you think, though, that various governments have done an insufficient job in promoting a positive case for refugees in particular? It's usually presented as a crisis, if not as an actual threat, then as, at best, a crisis to be managed. If governments were to sell the acceptance of refugees as potentially an opportunity for the country, and it very often is, as you know, the story of your own parents demonstrates, would electorates especially now be receptive to that, do you think?
Well, I think yes. Yes, governments have not done a good enough job of explaining, selling, providing context and justification and argumentation. I don't know whether or not they would have been persuasive in doing so. But it is striking, as someone who's obviously British, lives and works in the US, runs a charity that helps refugees and displaced people around the world, I'm struck by two things. One is that the US has been complacent about the refugee story. I mean, everyone from Albert Einstein, who founded the IRC, Madeleine Albright, who became Secretary of State, Sergey Brin, who founded Google, these are refugees who know the price of oppression and war and know the value of freedom. And my God, do they become productive and patriotic Americans. And their stories have just become part of a wider immigration story. They've not told that story. Secondly, though, in addition, I think that the demonization of the refugees, especially from Syria, by President Trump has been very, very striking in the last year or two. And it speaks to a wider question about the ethnic and religious makeup of the US. And I think that it's striking. I mean, the US is further from the Middle East than Europe, but the demonization has been that much greater.
That demonization of refugees, especially the Syrian ones you mentioned, has been a backdrop, of course, to two of the many recent political upheavals of our time, Brexit and Trump. You do address the rise of populism elsewhere in the book. When a government decides what to do about a refugee crisis, to what extent should it take into account anti-refugee feeling or anti-immigration feeling among electorates, even if a lot of that feeling is, you know, not coming from a good place, even if it is just xenophobia and ignorance? Because there's obviously a clear line to be drawn between Angela Merkel's generosity a couple of summers ago, very clear line from that to the fact that there's now 92, I think is the right number, AfD MPs sitting in the Bundestag.
Well, I think that the Merkel example is an interesting one, because I wouldn't describe it as a generous in terms of degrees of generosity. I think it was a recognition of reality. In fact, two realities that Mrs. Merkel faced in 2015. Reality number one was that there are already 400,000 asylum claimants in Germany by 2015. So she was already playing policy catch-up. Now, you can say that's partly her fault, that in 2013 and 2014, she and the whole of Europe had their eyes on the euro crisis and on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and the refugee crisis that was brewing in Lebanon and Jordan, the Syrian refugee crisis, was not addressed in a systematic or coherent way. Secondly, the second reality that she was addressing is that Europe's choice is either unregulated, illegal, undocumented, unplanned movements of people, or planned, organized, and recognized movements of people. And I think that she tried to address that situation. Actually, I think there are two realities have followed. One is that actually Germany is doing an extraordinary job of organising the processing of asylum claims and then the integration of people into German society. Secondly, there's been a political consequence. I think there's no point in denying that. The centre did hold in the German elections, but there was this growth of the AfD. And I think that the counterfactual is always hard in politics. My fear for her is that the counterfactual would have been far more damaging than her decision. Because the counterfactual, which is that you ignore the problem and say there's nothing that we're not going to address it, would have led to that ongoing, unplanned, disorganised movement of people that, frankly, would have been, I think, far more risky than the course that she chose.
Well, on the subject of counterfactuals, and as you correctly say, they are usually unanswerable and unknowable.
Almost by definition.
Which is why journalists so very much enjoy putting them to people. But obviously the ideal scenario in terms of refugees is that there is no reason ever for people to leave their homes. And if you think of the case of Syria in particular, is there or should there be more of an argument for taking, if necessary, military measures from the part of the West?
Well, look,
and various ideas were talked about, safe zones, no-fly zones.
There's a broader point here, which is a really important one, and podcasts like this are a chance to address it. There's a crisis of diplomacy.
Mm.
You have civil wars burning in Afghanistan, in Somalia, in Congo for 30 years.
Indeed.
And now you have wars starting in places like Yemen and in Syria, South Sudan, where, I mean, I live and work in New York now. There were no all-night sessions of the UN General Assembly in September to address these wars. So and you've got Rex Tillerson, currently Secretary of State in the US. He wants to cut the State Department by 30% because he's going to be so successful at stopping wars that he's not going to need diplomats anymore. I mean, this is not a serious way of addressing the world's problems. The truth is, you're right to say that my job is to treat the symptoms of political failure, not to tackle the roots of it. Now, the Syria crisis, I think, brings out a couple of things. One, the Western world should never have said Assad must go if it wasn't determined that it would follow the ends with the means.
Right.
In diplomacy, the greatest, or in foreign policy, the greatest danger or damage is when ends and means are divorced. Secondly, I have to be quite leery of getting involved in arguments about the military dimension for a very specific reason, which is that there are 1,200 IRC staff delivering healthcare, education, protection for women and kids, distributing cash to displaced people inside Syria. And so I have to be very careful. What I would say is that the Syria imbroglio, the Syria war, is an example of what happens when there is policy inaction as well as when there is policy action. I mean, the West has not engaged itself in a fundamental way in the Syria crisis. The vacuum has been filled, first of all, by President Assad, now by the Russians and the Iranians in a very big way. And I think that's dramatized the danger of this divorce of means and ends. And the tragedy of the Syria situation is that the lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan have not been learned. And the biggest lesson is that without a political settlement, without the prospect of a credible and legitimate sharing of political power, then these wars will not be brought to an end. And that remains the case today. Even though Assad has clearly got the upper hand, I don't think there's a prospect that the war is going to be over anytime soon because he doesn't have a credible and legitimate call on the loyalty of large numbers of his citizens.
You mentioned there the diplomatic void.
That's a better way of putting it. I said crisis, actually, void is a very good... That's a much more powerful way of saying it, because it's a void that's been created by the withdrawal of, fundamentally, the West from the diplomatic game or the diplomatic process that's so important.
But when you think about that, I guess, in terms of the job that you do, running an organisation like International Rescue, do you need to resign yourself, you and other NGOs, even other countries, other alliances, need to resign yourself to an absence of American leadership, which has been the traditional bedrock of the West, at least, until at least 2020? You referred recently to one of President Trump's online blurts as dangerous, irresponsible and hateful.
Well, that was about the retweeting of the fascist,
the Britain First tweets.
Rather than a particular international engagement. But I think it is very striking that the administration is determined to extricate itself from international diplomacy, the most recent example being the withdrawal of the US from the UN Migration Compact, which is a completely voluntary talking shop for how nations coordinate their activities. Now, what's interesting, though, is that you also have a withdrawal from the multilateral system, but more unilateral actions, the most recent example being about the status of Jerusalem and whether or not its status is part of final negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And so I do think, you said resign ourselves, I think we have to observe that the US is certainly withdrawing from the multilateral system. It's going to be taking more unilateral actions which will not be agreed with others. One consequence of that is that the diplomacy is weakened. The other is that impunity rises. Impunity of actors in conflict, be they governments or terrorist groups.
Well, I was about to ask whether that absence or that void does present opportunities, and I did mean opportunities in a positive sense, but as you point out, it's also going to mean opportunities in a negative
sense. The
void,
which is a word I think is appropriate, is filled by bad actors more than good actors. And I am struck, it's never been more dangerous to be a aid worker. It's never been more dangerous to be a civilian in wartime.
It's certainly rarely been more dangerous to be a journalist, I suspect, for similar reasons.
In war zones, yeah. Mm. The trouble with impunity is that it's catching. In that, look, I was in the Jaffna Peninsula in 2009 as UK Foreign Secretary when there was impunity in respect of Tamil civilians who were caught up in the end of the Sri Lankan Civil War. Since 2011 in Syria, it's become an advertisement for impunity. And that is, I think, has long-term consequences. If there's no accountability for effectively war crimes, then it spreads. I mean, what's happening in Yemen at the moment, the targeting of civilians, is an appalling... I mean, it's been called by the UN collective punishment. What's happened in Myanmar has been called by the UN ethnic cleansing. I mean, these are depth that have been plumbed in human history but have been relatively unplumbed in the last 40 or 50 years. And the fact that we now have seemingly a wild west in the international system is very dangerous.
Is that wild westernization, if you will, of the international system? Do you see that as a consequence of, and this is something you do address in the book, of the intervention in Iraq in 2003? Did that dent the West's moral authority to the extent that the institutions that moral authority underpinned have begun to crack?
Well, I think it dented the moral authority, but it also created a political retreat that has been very, very striking. Now, part of that retreat is well merited. There's a sobriety, a humility, a care about...
You do address your own support for the intervention in the book.
Yeah, and my regret of that, because I think it was clearly a mistake. But the sobriety, the humility is right about the use of military force. The imprisonment in the wake of Iraq and Afghanistan, for international policy to be imprisoned by a sense that anything we do abroad is going to go wrong, I think is dangerous.
That was David Miliband, former UK Foreign Secretary and President of the International Rescue Committee. His book, Rescue, Refugees and the Political Crisis of Our Time, is published by TED Books. I'm Andrew Muller. This is The Foreign Desk. Thank you very much for listening.